Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Hurricane Harvey tore through Texas this week, dumping over 50 inches of rain and turning the streets of Houston into rivers. Americans responded with compassion and action as they used helicopters, boats, and even an inflatable air mattress to rescue stranded neighbors. Climate scientists have predicted for years that we'd experience more intense hurricanes and other major weather disruptions. In addition to immediate disaster relief, what can we do to prevent or limit the impact of these weather events? What can communities do to prepare for the dramatic weather conditions that now are inevitable? Is it possible to have severe weather without it becoming such a catastrophe? Our two guests today are on the front lines of taking action on climate change in two regions of the country. Our first guest, Mike Tidwell, is the founder and director of Chesapeake Climate Action Network in the Maryland, D.C., Virginia region. Following him will be Jennifer Gerardo, who is developing plans to deal with flooding and other climate challenges for southern Florida. First, we hear from Mike Tidwell, the founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, a grassroots nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness about the impacts and solutions associated with global warming in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. He is also an author and filmmaker who predicted the Katrina hurricane disaster in his book, Bayou Farewell, The Rich Life and Tragic Death of Louisiana's Cajun Coast. His most recent book, focusing on Katrina and global warming, is titled The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Race to Save America's Coastal Cities. Mike Tidwell, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, well, I've been tracking your work for years, and you do great work, and of course, timely now more than ever. Do you see Hurricane Harvey in Texas as part of climate change, or what do you see as the connection?
Well, I think that worldwide, whenever we find ourselves saying, I never saw that before, it's a pretty good indication that the weather extreme we're seeing is related to climate change. Unfortunately, we're seeing record droughts worldwide that no one's seen before. We're seeing wildfires that no one's seen before, Arctic ice melt that we've never seen before. And now we're seeing a hurricane with a precipitation volume that no one's ever seen before in North America. We're approaching 60 inches of rain in some areas. It is clear that the fingerprints of climate change are all over this, both because warming Gulf of Mexico waters give greater fuel to hurricanes, thus making them more powerful. But also, and I think what's most notable here, is that a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture, and a warmer atmosphere causes the oceans to evaporate faster. So you have more water literally in the atmosphere all over the world. And what we're finding is storms like Harvey, while perhaps not ignited and caused originally by climate change, are just making them a lot worse in terms of the sheer amount of rain that comes down. And certainly that's what we saw in Texas.
Yeah, that was an impressive display by nature. Thank you for that explanation. That really makes sense. So we probably would have had a hurricane even without the climate change situation we're in. But from what you're saying, it's the warming atmosphere and the warming waters just brings more moisture into the atmosphere. So it makes Harvey, as an example, a much more destructive storm. Is that right?
That's correct. And climate scientists have measured that just since the 1970s, the amount of moisture in the global atmosphere has gone up about 4%. We're also finding that extreme precipitation events across North America are rising. in the last few decades. And it's sort of like if you take a shower in with cold water, when you get out, your mirror is not all fogged up. But if you take a shower in warm water, that air in the room you're in holds more moisture, and then that gets all over the mirror and it's all over everything. And that's what we're finding. There's just more moisture in the atmosphere because the atmosphere is warmer. And what we're also learning is that what goes up eventually comes down. And what we're finding in climate change is that it comes down in bursts. The precipitation is extreme. And now, I mean, I saw one scholar saying earlier today that the parts of Texas that are approaching 60 inches of rain, that's basically a 1-in-a-million-year flood. In other words, it's just so far off the charts, no one can even comprehend it.
All right, and yet these more frequent, more intense hurricanes seem to be happening more and more, like you said, that never seen it before is kind of a characteristic of this climate change that we're now in, very much in the middle of. We're not predicting the future anymore. Then, you know, the future is now. We're experiencing climate change. And I was very impressed that 2 years before Hurricane Katrina hit, in 2003, you wrote the book Bayou Farewell, The Rich Life and Tragic Death of Louisiana's Cajun Coast. You are the only one I know who predicted Hurricane Katrina. How did you know that was going to happen, and why did you write the book?
Well, for years and years, I was a freelance writer for a number of magazines and newspapers, including the Washington Post. And I had an editor at the Sunday Travel section of the Washington Post who, in the spring of 1999, asked me to go to Louisiana and write any story I wanted. It was an open-ended assignment. And I wound up having this crazy idea of hitchhiking across South Louisiana, not by car, but by boat, because of the bayous and the swamps and the colorful Cajun communities along the Gulf of Mexico. I thought, wow, wouldn't that be interesting if I could just go from town to town, thumbing on shrimp boats and crab boats and oyster boats. And turns out it was possible, and I did it, and I had an amazing experience, sort of Huck Finn experience. This was in the late spring of 1999. But as I met these amazing Cajun fishermen and began to fall even more deeply in love with their food and their French language and the music, they began pointing out to me that that whole ragged soul of the Louisiana boot was destined to be wiped out by a major hurricane soon. And I asked them why, and they started to point out the fact that land was disappearing all around. And they showed me evidence of entire forests that were sinking into the ocean in South Louisiana, and beaches that had been destroyed, wetlands that were just dissolving away, in part because of sea level rise, and that's a big part of it. The oceans are rising and just eroding that whole fragile flat part of South Louisiana, but also the land itself is sinking for various reasons, including because of all the oil drilling that the oil and gas industry have done under the ground that literally causes large areas of that land to sink. And so they were telling me, look, without this land, without the wetlands and the beaches and the barrier islands, we're going to be wiped out. Hurricanes are just getting further inland, and it's just a matter of time before New Orleans and the other coastal cities are just completely wiped out by a major hurricane. And so I found this very, very compelling, and I wrote this book, Bayou Farewell, that basically just gives voice to these Cajun people, both to voice to their incredible culture, which is disappearing, but also the very land that they live on and how it's disappearing, and makes inevitable a really, really big destructive hurricane. And so they were the ones who educated me, a fellow American, about the fact that Katrina was coming. And that time in 1999, they didn't know what to call the hurricane, right? They just said a major hurricane is coming, but they were describing Katrina. So in my 2003 book, when it finally came out, that was a central theme, is that this is a fragile land, vulnerable because of human influence to a great human, human-caused disaster. And then within 2 years, that disaster came in the form of Katrina.
Wow, what an amazing story. And yes, that incredible hurricane hit in 2005. So now you're talking 12 years ago, we had the forceful impact of Hurricane Katrina. As you predicted, as the Cajun people had shared with you, they saw coming. What do you think we learned from Hurricane Katrina? I mean, that's the first time I remember such a dramatic hurricane that really kind of broke through the psyche and the news cycle in the country about how intense a hurricane can be and how devastating it can be for some of our communities and cities. Do you think we learned anything from Katrina? Are we better prepared now to deal with these more frequent and more intense hurricanes?
I would love to say that we did learn a lot and that Katrina was a teachable moment and the country learned some important lessons that help us prepare for and deal with and ultimately prevent future storms like this. But I think you look at Hurricane Harvey and you see that we haven't learned a lot. One of the clear messages from Katrina was that sea level rise was exacerbating the amount of surge tide that hurricanes were bringing on shore. Literally, it's almost like if you have a basketball player and a basketball court, and they dunk a basketball, that's impressive. But if you then raise the floor of the basketball court closer and closer to the basket, then those slam dunks just are easier to do, and they get more spectacular, and then they happen more often. And that's what we're doing in terms of hurricanes now. We're literally, raising the ocean so that slam dunk hurricanes are becoming more common, whether it's Katrina, Rita, Wilma, Sandy, and now Harvey. We're just bringing the ocean closer to the land and to the cities and communities. The lesson that we need to learn from that is that is to ask ourselves what's causing the sea level rise, and it's global climate change. And you would think that after Katrina and Sandy, we would have a national policy taking us faster and faster toward renewable energy. But unfortunately, we're going in the opposite direction here recently with the Trump administration at the federal level, and he's pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. So that is the opposite of learning lessons from Sandy and Katrina. I also, it's clear from Hurricane Harvey that we're still in denial about the sheer force and disruptive power of climate change induced megastorms. We have to begin asking ourselves, are many of our coastal cities inhabitable? And if so, what do we need to do to improve evacuation measures, to provide humanitarian aid faster, to build more resilient roads and bridges, and all the things that we're going to have to do if we intend to continue to occupy our coastal areas when the oceans could rise as much as 3, 4, 5 feet by the end of the century. So there are a lot of policies that we still need. One, to reduce global warming by getting off of fossil fuels, and two, to obviously do more in the wake of Harvey and Katrina to prepare for these storms in terms of the humanitarian impact.
Right, exactly. Well, we should have been forewarned with Katrina, and there's obviously some similarities and some differences there. It seems like with Hurricane Katrina, Louisiana was it's almost inevitable with all the lowlands there that hurricanes would come and kind of wipe out some of the area. With Houston, though, it seems like there's an added piece there where there's been so much incredible development in Houston and unrestrained development, like with no regulation. So you have, whatever it is, 100,000 people a year moving into the Houston area and moving, going wherever they wanted to go, including around those reservoirs, two giant reservoirs, which used to be out in the wilderness, now had people surrounding them. So when the reservoirs overflowed, you know, all those homes got put underwater. So it seems like, you know, some important similarities and differences there, but we need to be factoring in global climate change to everything that we're doing, and up to the point which you mentioned, which I think a lot of people will say is very dramatic, but I think you're right. We need to ask which, you know, are all these coastal communities really habitable now, given the inevitable rising of the sea levels and the inevitable megastorms that are going to be coming. And I think, you know, people are just still in denial and unwilling to look at that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think denial is an incredibly powerful human phenomenon. And it's not just that, you know, we deny climate change and the day-to-day impacts of climate change. You know, we deny that Uncle Fred is an alcoholic and that we're in bad, you know, marital relationships or what have you. We're just masters of denial, we human beings. Unfortunately, when it comes to climate change, if we continue this level of denial, we're going to find that not just Houston is uninhabitable, but the entire planet is uninhabitable. You know, we are all New Orleanians now. We are all Houstonians. We have but one small planetary island to live on in this vast darkness of space. You know, ultimately, there is no safe shore to take us. There's nowhere to run, and we have to start dealing with these issues in a clear-eyed manner. And that involves, again, we have to get off of fossil fuels. We can't be building pipelines like the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access pipeline. We cannot bring coal back. There's no place for coal on a rapidly warming planet. There's no place for fracking. We have to make the rapid switch to electric cars and increasingly cost-effective and affordable solar and wind. And these are all technologies within our possession now. We don't have to invent any silver bullet to get off of fossil fuels. We have everything we need now. What we're lacking is policies. And that's why it's encouraging that a lot of the states are moving forward, despite Trump, are moving rapidly forward in big leaps and bounds toward clean energy, like California, like the New England states, the upper Midwest, and others. But we also have to have policies where we begin to adapt to the global warming we can no longer avoid. You know, often climate scientists say we need to avoid the global warming levels that we cannot adapt to, and we need to adapt to the global warming that we can no longer avoid. And so it's a two-step process. We got to stop making the problem worse, while at the same time we have to realistically look at parts of Houston and South Louisiana and coastal Virginia and other areas and say, look, what parts of these areas are going to be permanently underwater in the next few decades? And what is our policy? Where, how do we equitably relocate certain populations? I mean, there are populations of Houma Indians in South Louisiana who are already looking for land to relocate to and deeper in the interior of Louisiana. There are entire populations in the South Pacific that are signing treaties with larger countries to send their populations to. And that is a sad reality, but it's one that because of our slowness to stop burning fossil fuels, we've put ourselves in a situation where we're going to have more Katrinas, we're going to have more Harveys, and we have to start realistically saying no to developers who want to build everywhere, who want to continue to build on beach lines. I mean, there are apartment and office building developments in Miami and New York City right now that are being constructed right now. The cranes are pouring the concrete right now, and those same buildings are flooding from high tides, from sea level rise. I mean, as they're being built, they're being flooded by sea level rise. It's just insane. And yet we have policies in this country that continue to guarantee insurance and zoning preferences for that kind of development. It's insane.
Right, you're absolutely right. And our next guest is going to be talking exactly about that situation in Florida with the flooding that's happening. They don't need any big hurricanes now. They're just having flooding on a regular basis as the sea level is rising. So we're going to hear more about that momentarily. But you make an eloquent and passionate plea for moving beyond denial and addressing the climate change that we're facing. And you're right. We need a mix both of preventing what we can still prevent, but dealing with what's unpreventable now. And we've already got so much of the carbon released in there. We're already having climate change impact on a regular basis. So you laid out a number of action steps to take, which are great. And I'm glad you mentioned, by the way, even though the current occupant of the White House has been trying to reverse the Paris Accord, the states, and I would add the cities, are still being heroic and moving forward in working to reduce the carbon emissions. So that's some good news. And what can our listeners do? Like, you mentioned a thing, we don't need new technology. We have what we need. We need different policies. What advice can you give our listeners? That we're educated. We care. What can we do to help address this situation?
Well, I get asked a lot by people in community meetings and church basements and high school cafeterias and people who are eager to do something on climate change. And they'll say, look, we're freaked out. You have our attention. We're concerned about, the latest Hurricane Harvey or droughts or unusual weather right where people live, and they want to know what they can do, but they caution that they can't do 10 things. Don't give them a list of 10 things to do. What is the single most important thing they can do? I get that question all the time, and my answer is always the same. Develop a relationship with one group that's fighting climate change where you live, whether it's the city you live in, at the state level, national, whatever it is, find a group and develop a relationship with that group so that you are active with that group. And the best way to do that is to simply sign up for the email alerts of that group that you have in mind. I mean, that's the organizing that I do in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., in and all around the White House, primarily is based on emails. And as many emails as we get, and we're overwhelmed by them, it's still the number one way people find out about marches and community meetings. And so I would say, pick that group. If you live in the upper Midwest, there's a great group called Fresh Energy that's fighting for clean energy in Minnesota and the Dakotas. If you live on the Pacific Northwest, there's a great group called Climate Solutions. Look up their website and get on their email list. If you are in the Chesapeake Bay region of Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., go to our website, chesapeakeclimate.org, and you'll see the tab. Sign up for action alerts. And that way you can continue to know about things happening regularly in your community, the next city council vote, the next general assembly vote, the next big rally happening, and you'll have an ongoing relationship with that group. That's the number one thing that you can do. Get on somebody's email list.
That's great. And you are a wonderful model for what can be done on a regional basis as the founder and director of Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Why don't you talk just a little bit about the kind of work that you do in that region, just so people get a flavor of what can actually be done?
Yeah, well, what we're working on is a number of things. We have to play defense because the fossil fuel industry is still aggressively trying to move their agenda forward despite the extreme climate events that we're seeing. They want to move forward with extreme fossil fuels. So fracking in Maryland, we just banned fracking forever in Maryland. It's never going to happen. And we do have Marcellus Shale gas reserves in the western part of Maryland, but the General Assembly in Annapolis voted by huge numbers to ban it forever. So we're happy about that. In the District of Columbia, we are working with the city council there to put a tax on carbon, carbon fuel use. So there would be a carbon tax on gas for home heating, gasoline for cars, coal-fired electricity, and then that money collected from that tax would be rebated to individual residents. They would literally get an equal share carbon rebate check every month. And it's proving to be a very popular idea. We're not trying to create a bunch of additional government. We're trying to simply put a price on carbon and give the money back to residents in a very equitable and progressive way. And that could be a model for states across the country. And then in Virginia, mostly we're fighting Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe, who supports two massive pipelines for frack gas. They're kind of like the Keystone XL pipelines for frack gas that he wants to build from West Virginia into Virginia, and it would just trigger an enormous new pulse of fossil fuel, of carbon emissions or greenhouse gas emissions in the state. And so we've got a campaign to stop that and to raise our voices all across the state of Virginia, while at the same time we're promoting offshore wind power as an excellent, excellent alternative for the state of Virginia, which has a very, very windy coastline with shallow waters right next to an excellent harbor in the form of Norfolk and Newport News and Hampton Roads. So it's an ideal industry for coastal Virginia. So we're working on solutions while at the same time fighting the last-ditch efforts of the fossil fuel industry to addict us to extreme forms of oil, coal, and gas.
Fantastic. Well, you're doing wonderful work. And tell our listeners, how can they contact you to support what you're doing, get some more information? Is there a website they can go to?
Yeah, you can reach me through my website. Again, it's ChesapeakeClimate.org. And you can send me a message that way. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us there and learn more about all our campaigns. And, you know, in the short term, I hope that your listeners, as I'm sure they've heard appeals already, but make a donation to the poor people of Texas. I just can't imagine the days on end of being wet and having a flooded home and flooded streets and just the sound of water and the sight of water and wet pets being dramatically rescued and tragically people drowning. It's just it's unfathomable, but they're living it day to day and they need our help. So I hope that folks will join me and others in making a donation to groups that are helping the humanitarian crisis, but then start to concentrate and focus on what's causing these kind of storms. Help us fight climate change. Develop a relationship with a group in your city or your region who's fighting for clean energy and against extreme energy. You know, it's a race against time, and we're running out of time, and we need everyone's help.
That's great, and I encourage our listeners to contact you at the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. That's all the time we have. Mike Tidwell of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your vital work.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's time now for a station break, and then we'll be back with our next guest.
This is the Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
This is Rob Simons. Join me Mondays at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on my new show called Moving Forward. This show will cover my thoughts about the world and what to do moving forward. These thoughts will venture into environmental issues, United States foreign and domestic policies, putting historical events in context, and current events. So join me on the Progressive Radio Network, on a station that moves forward, and we'll be discussing how we can move forward.
Climate change is one of the great challenges of our time. Some Republicans, including the current occupant of the White House, are trying to reverse progress made addressing climate change. Trump wants to renege on U.S. pledges to the Paris Climate Agreement, remove regulations on coal emissions, and weaken or eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency. Last week, the president signed an executive order rolling back the Clean Power Plan, President Obama's key measure to fight climate change by limiting carbon emissions from power plants and requiring states to cut overall emissions. We should fight these moves by the Trump administration and Republican Congress and see them as a call to action for all citizens. But despite these obstacles, strong action by leaders in government, business, and communities continue to address climate change and protect our environment. Some local and state leaders are carrying forward with plans to cut carbon emissions and shift from fossil fuels like coal and oil to renewable energy. About 30 states have set standards requiring power companies to sharply increase their use of renewable energy. Some states like California and Illinois are requiring serious cuts in the greenhouse gas emissions. And while the coal industry employs about 65,000 people, the renewable energy industry employs 10 times as many workers, about 650,000 jobs and growing. The move to renewable energy is unstoppable. Nowhere is the battle against climate change more intense than in southern Florida, where rising sea levels are already regularly flooding coastal areas. Billions of homes and businesses' value are threatened by the rising sea. Our guest today is one of the champions on the front lines of addressing climate change in southern Florida. Jennifer Gerardo is the director of the Environmental Protection and Growth Management Department for Broward County, Florida. Jennifer Gerardo, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So we met 2 weeks ago at the Rachel's Network gathering, Women Committed to the Environment and Women's Leadership, and you blew me away with how brilliant you are, how well-informed you are, and how committed you are to dealing with the climate change and the rising seas in South Florida. So thank you for the great work you're doing.
Well, thank you for the opportunity and your interest in sharing these issues with the audience today.
So can you tell our listeners what is actually happening in the communities there now? I was actually a little shocked at how advanced the rising seas are in affecting communities already in South Florida. So tell us what the communities there are facing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've measured regionally 9 inches of sea level rise since the early 1900s. And for many other parts of the nation and shorelines, perhaps 9 inches wouldn't have as dramatic impacts as it does here. But we have a very flat and low-lying landscape and very intense urban development. So these minor changes in sea level are quite significant when we consider that a lot of the infrastructure in our region was built around the 1950s or so, and much of this rise has occurred since the infrastructure has been designed. And as a result, we have, especially in the last 10 years, begun to experience quite significant, severe, and prolonged tidal flooding that occurs throughout the fall season during the periods of peak tides that really has dramatic impacts on our communities. What was once considered what we call nuisance flooding that might occur for a day in a month or a couple of times a year can now occur for, say, 30 days in a year, inundating neighborhoods with more than a foot of salt water that extends across entire roadways, disrupting traffic, disrupting commerce, killing the landscaping, damaging vehicles, isolating people in their residences or in their places of work, and really just having very dramatic implications for services and quality of life. This is very dramatic down in the Florida Keys, very impactful in the Miami Beach area. Several communities in my county and here in Broward are considered to be quite vulnerable. So it's really in the last several years quite awakening for residents and business leaders and elected officials who've been attuned to these issues, but there's a growing demand for resources to be aligned to help address the flooding.
Yeah, that's a great description of it. And as some of the pictures, I wish our listeners could see them, but maybe they can find them on the internet. But actually seeing the flood waters, just the sea, like you said, you know, used to be a nuisance flooding or occasional. Now it's happening pretty frequently. You're getting water across the roads, so roads become impassable. They're damaging the vehicles, like you mentioned, the cars and people's homes. And, you know, I don't know what the number is, but it's got to be in the billions of dollars. That's such a heavily, you know, heavy concentration of people living there, of businesses operating there. Do you have any idea, like, the scale of how much is at risk given this rising sea level flooding?
Well, with 1 foot of sea level rise, it is heavily conservatively estimated at $3 billion, and that's not including the figures for Miami-Dade County. Those were not included in the initial estimates that we arrived at. With 3 feet of sea level rise, still heavily conservative at $6 billion in taxable infrastructure. And the reason that that's a very conservative number is it only takes into account elevation and the value of the property at a presumed impacted level of seas rise. But the situation is much, much more complex than that for us here because the water doesn't just spill over the landscape. The seas are actually rising beneath our feet. We have a very porous geology. And so as sea level rises 1 foot, the coastal groundwater elevations are rising a foot as well. We're losing storage in the geology that is critical when it rains. The soils store a lot of water, and as you lose capacity in the soils, that water now floods the landscape. In addition, the entire water management and drainage system from the region east to west is a part of a complex canal network, and the ability to drain any of rainfall from the landscape is contingent upon water being able to run downstream or downslope and empty into the coastal waters. And as seas rise, that gradient is reduced and the discharge capacity is reduced. So as a result, communities that are maybe at a higher elevation or much further inland are also experiencing flooding associated with rising seas, even though they're not part of the waterfront. So, again, those numbers are very, very conservative, and we're just now undertaking the much more complex hydrologic modeling that will begin to tell a more complete story.
Right. And so you mentioned there the 1 foot rise. Like, how long are they thinking it's going to take to have the sea level rise a foot?
We're planning for about a foot of rise by about 2035. We're planning for a full 2 feet of sea level rise by 2050. We are organizing our planning efforts around an estimated 2 feet of sea level rise, as I said, in the 2050-2060 timeframe. And we consider that to be quite reasonable given the nature of planning and investments that's required. We have to take that into account. And the trajectory when we look at emissions and its influence on warming and thermal expansion of the oceans and ice melt, those projections are never decreasing. They're always increasing. And so I think we've estimated that the practical consideration is to assume 2 feet. And if we're fortunate enough that it takes an additional 10 years before that that rise actually occurs. Nonetheless, it's still part of what's already baked into the system, and we do need to prepare for it.
Absolutely, because we're not going to be reversing climate change anytime soon. It just, you're right, every time they come out with an estimate, it's always worse than what we thought it was going to be. And you're talking, even with your very conservative numbers, that within about 18 years, by 2035, would see that 1 foot sea level rise. And you're saying that's affecting at least $3 billion worth of property plus the Miami area. this is like major people's lives. This is like one of the most concentrated living areas, I think, in the country. And it has to be one of the greatest at-risk places in the world. And when you think about sea level rising, now I know there's some islands out there which could be completely covered and we lose them, but this has certainly got to be one of the top places in the world where we're feeling the impact of the sea rise from the climate change right now. Is that true? Like, where does Southern Florida fit in terms of the global picture of impact on climate change?
Well, we are one of the most vulnerable areas in the nation. I mean, clearly there are low-lying islands and other communities, and you know, China also has great vulnerabilities to sea level rise, and areas of India, and you know, so there are clearly other areas. But what makes our region somewhat unique, and the rate of rise can even be higher in other areas because perhaps they're subsiding, and so they're realizing a rate that's accelerated. But we have the unique fortune of having such a concentration, as you said, of really high concentration of population and valuable real estate. So the economic implications of unmitigated sea level rise are quite significant. Our four counties of Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe, which constitute Southeast Florida, have a population of about 6 million. We make up collectively one-third of our state's gross domestic product by way of economic activity. And Florida's economic output is the fourth largest of the states in our nation. So there are dramatic economic consequences, not just for our region and not just for our state, but for our nation. And then when you take into account that coastal counties account for nearly 50% of our state's GDP, there is a national interest and what happens to the economies of coastal communities if we choose not to invest in resilient infrastructure and mitigation measures that can help rein in and harness the rate of future rise. When we think about all the educational services and the health services and the infrastructure that is supported by economies that line our coastlines, it is a national imperative that we organize the resources. Otherwise, climate impacts that may be further out in the future or even realized today in areas that have agricultural interests, there won't be the resources to address those impacts either because they'll be so intimately connected to the resources that are derived from the coastal economies.
Yeah, that's a very dramatic situation. I think it's very accurate. We have got to address this whole situation. And I am so impressed with what you're doing. So tell us a little bit about you. You're really a champion on the rising sea levels for our coastal communities. What's the mission of your department? What are you doing to deal with this onslaught? We're not talking like 50 years from now. We're saying right now there's rising sea level that's damaging homes, it's damaging roads, it's damaging cars, it's damaging businesses and hotels that are on the coast of South Florida. What are you doing about it? What can be done?
Well, within our agency, we're charged with the resiliency initiatives that are specific to our county operations, that are shared initiatives with our 31 municipalities that are part of Broward County. And we're also partners in what we refer to as the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact. The four counties I mentioned came together in 2010, and we've been formally addressing shared climate mitigation and adaptation challenges at the regional level since that time. Our work involves water resource policy planning and management, shoreline protection, environmental monitoring, energy and sustainability, urban and natural areas, lands, coral reef conservation, a broad array of environmental initiatives, but then also focused on the integration of urban and natural systems. We have a very strong history of collaboration with many of our federal agencies, and we would not be so well armed to take these issues at hand if it weren't for our work with the United States Geologic Service. We have, for more than a decade, worked to develop very advanced hydrologic models that do allow us to understand how sea level rise will impact our geology, our hydrology. And as a result, we're undertaking pretty, I think, dramatic and forward-thinking changes in our regulatory process where we're formally planning for future flood conditions. And in fact, we're right now going through the process of amending what is in our code of ordinances to require that drainage infrastructure will have to be designed with the future flood condition in mind, and not in mind. I mean, it's part of formal maps. So our mapping of 2 feet of sea level rise and how we have to organize infrastructure around that condition. We're also undertaking a process of updating our flood, they're called the finished floor elevations, the lowest elevation of a floor for residential and commercial buildings for flood conditions with 2 feet of sea level rise. So those are fairly progressive. We're also working with the Army Corps of Engineers to undertake advanced modeling that combines analyses of future sea level rise and high tides and storm events. So all the, you know, the combination of conditions that contribute to flooding, organizing that around the 2 foot sea level rise scenario as well, so that we can come up with regional top elevations for seawalls. Basically, the idea is that we need to keep as much water out of the landscape as possible. We need to install infrastructure, namely in the way of pumps and valves that prevent backflow of water through our storm systems to block and manage the water that would otherwise come in. And we need to elevate infrastructure where, because of our geology, water will undoubtedly begin to occupy more of the landscape. And I think that those engineering solutions, those design strategies, building resiliency into the landscape, we can probably manage pretty well with 2 to 3 feet of sea level rise, recognizing, however, that there will be areas that will probably deem too challenging or too costly to be able to mitigate the floodwaters entirely. But those areas, I think, will be identified over the coming decades, and our efforts, though, will be focused on trying to preserve what we can, and at the same time looking for forward-thinking national policy and state policy and local initiatives that can be more aggressive on renewable energies and see if we can't begin to literally turn the tide.
Oh, I love that, turn the tide. That's fantastic. Well, and just to be clear for our listeners here, what you're talking about with the sea level rise, the flooding is not happening when there is a major storm or a flood or a hurricane. We're talking about just on your regular average, you know, high tide day that now there's flooding that's happening. So it's encouraging that you think you can manage it up to 2 to 3 feet rise if you keep on your current track. But the other thing, which we haven't really mentioned much at all, is as the saltwater sea level rises, how that impacts the freshwater supply for southern Florida. So I would think, you know, any of the underwater tables could easily get the salination, the salt in them, and then make it undrinkable. What's the risk there in terms of the drinking water supply for South Florida?
Well, that's a very real risk. And in fact, we've been managing saltwater intrusion within the aquifer for decades. Saltwater intrusion has been a problem simply because we have drained so much of the landscape in order for the urban population to exist here. If had it not been drained, we'd be flooded all the time. We're occupying area that was previously part of the Florida Everglades. So we've dramatically changed the hydrology of the region, and as a result, saltwater intrusion has historically been an issue. However, the regional policy has prevented any additional withdrawals from the aquifer since 2006, withdrawals above historic rates. So the saltwater intrusion that will occur with time will be driven by sea level rise. There we've worked with, the USGS, to model the relative contributions of land use and changes in well field operations and sea level rise, the variety of factors to understand how much of an influence is sea level rise on saltwater intrusion. And what we've learned is that the rate of rise to date has accelerated by a factor of 2, the landward movement of the front. And in looking at the coming decades, by 2060, again, with 2 feet of sea level rise, we expect to lose about 40% of our coastal well field capacity. That's equivalent to about 35 million gallons per day in potable water supply that we need today. That's not even accounting for future populations. So it requires some forward thinking about our aggressive conservation initiatives, which we do have in place, developing alternative water supplies such as reclaimed water, moving well fields, harvesting storm water for reuse is another potential that is being developed. But we do need to be cognizant that as we move to alternative water supplies, all of those will require higher levels of treatment, hence energy, than our current water treatment technologies. And that is not entirely consistent with what we're seeking to achieve with emissions reductions. And, you know, the treatment and movement of water is one of the most energy-intensive demands on the grid. And we need to be very thoughtful and also seek advancements in the efficiencies of those technologies as water management becomes more difficult in the ensuing years.
Right. Did I hear you correctly? You said by the year 2060 that you expect to lose about 40% of the current fresh water supply?
Of the coastal well fields, it's about 16% of, if we talk about Broward County, it's about 16% of all of our water capacity, but it's 40% of the coastal. And the reason that there is a distinction there, we have very distinct treatment facilities and water quality from west to east. And so treatment facilities that are treating water from the east today are not the same facilities that can treat water in the future. So there's a very, distinct infrastructure considerations that are at hand.
Right. Well, you're doing an amazing job, and it's, you know, very serious threat, and, you know, something, not just a threat, it's happening now and will definitely intensify. And I have to ask you, because I wondered it when I was down there, given the intensity of the sea level rise and given how low level South Florida is, and given the vulnerability of the water supply, do you think we're really going to be able to save the coastal communities of Southern Florida, or is it already too late?
Well, I think that over time there will be concessions that will very likely be made in some of the most vulnerable areas. I think that we will find that there are certain communities where either because of the difficulties in managing flooding, perhaps the cost of insurance, perhaps a severe storm that results in damage in an area will drive reconsideration about development and whether that would be prudent. I think that there will be changes that occur from a variety of influences that will drive, different occupational kind of patterns of the landscape. And it may just be a matter of, affordability, risk and disruption, a combination of things. So I don't think that it's going to be the exact same landscape, certainly in 2060 or 2090 or 2100.
Yeah, well, certainly you're on the case and you're extremely well informed and you've got a great plan. It's very encouraging. And how can our listeners support you in the work you're doing? Is there anything that we can do to help you?
I think it's very important that our leaders, whether they are local or at the state level or at the national level, understand that we don't have the luxury of deferring on this issue. There isn't any debate. communities are impacted today. It's just a matter of whether or not we're willing to accept that dialogue. And for some, maybe it's not convenient. But ultimately, somebody is going to inherit the liability. It'll be the community today, or it's going to be the next generation. And we have to consider the what level of options do we want to leave for those who follow us, and how complex and navigable is that landscape going to be if we don't take aggressive responsibilities today. So demanding support for our federal agencies, the use of climate science in decision-making, support for the National Climate Assessment. Those activities are just now ramping up again. The leadership of our and participation of our federal agencies in that process is vital. Communities need that information to support decision-making. Investments in clean energy and clean energy policy, and supporting elected officials as they're getting ready to make potentially some difficult decisions, such in our community about more progressive standards. Elected leaders need to know that they have the backing of their community as they're standing up and making decisions that have longer term implications that may be short term politically not as attractive as another, but it takes great leadership from elected officials to make the types of decisions that are based upon realities of 20 years and not just the next 6 months. And they need to know that the community is behind them.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And it's been, one of the things, I think it was President John F. Kennedy said, a good politician thinks about the next election and a great statesman thinks about the next generation. It really seems like, given what we're facing right now in South Florida, we need to have great statesmen who are thinking not just about how do I get elected next time, but like you're saying, someone's going to inherit this liability. What can we do now to mitigate the problem, to adapt to the problem, and to do whatever infrastructure changes we need to do to make those areas habitable down the road?
Yes, and I think, too, there's so much to be derived from an economic standpoint. I mean, I think we widely recognize that infrastructure has been underinvested in. If there's opportunities to have cost efficiencies and clean technologies, why wouldn't we take advantage of that? Why wouldn't we want to empower, especially underrepresented communities who may be struggling with the cost of current energy pricing with alternatives that would open up the field? So as a community, as a population, as a nation, there's so much to be gained short-term by leading in these advancements and long-term by shoring up and protecting our communities from risk and losses and hazards and continuing to have robust economies. It's really difficult to understand why any alternative would be debated.
Right, exactly. And if you had 1 minute to talk to the members of Congress and our president, what would you say to them?
Well, I'll have an opportunity tomorrow. On Monday, where there's actually going to be a Senate hearing, a field hearing down here in South Florida with some of our senators and congressional members. And the message that we're delivering is that the time for action has long passed. We don't have the luxury of awaiting another election cycle or a period or opportunity of convenience. The resources have got to be organized now. We are forced to respond to conditions that are already in motion, but at the same time, we have to take the responsibility to try to bracket the magnitude of change that will be occurring long after we are gone. We have to marry those two efforts, and so we're urging continued leadership on clean energy policy and an organization of investments in resilient infrastructure that will benefit our communities now and for the coming decades. And it's a matter of national consequence. It's not pitting one community against another. We are all mutually invested in how we choose to respond as a nation.
That is really well said, and I'm hoping with the move now in our current budget to put more money into the national defense and less into the other programs, it sounds to me like the work that you're doing is a critical matter of national defense, and that they should take some of those hundreds of billions of dollars they're using in defense and put it into building resilient communities and developing the renewable energy sources. So that is all the time we have. Jennifer Durato, thank you so much for being with us today, and I really appreciate the great work you're doing there in South Florida. You're wonderful, and I wish you great success.
Eleanor, thank you so much for having me on your program today, and I really appreciate you bringing this audience or this message to the broader audience. Thank you.
In case you've missed any of our programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.